Let's talk. John Brown. So William Lyons on Jaguar, the legend explained in his own words. This is a book about Jaguar with a difference. And the man who's going to tell me all about it is a frequent contributor to this show, delighted to say that the motorist motoring writer, Giles Chapman, joins us. Morning to you, Giles.
What an intro. I mean, thank you so much. What can I say?
Well, you can say good morning, Giles. I mean, it's Giles speaking to Giles this morning, which is very rare indeed.
Very kind. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me again.
Pleasure. Well, last time we were talking about, what was it, three times around the world in a Volvo or something like that?
Yes. It was my little book about motoring eccentrics. But the guy I'm talking about in this book is not eccentric at all.
Really. Yeah.
So it's a slightly different topic.
So for those, because of course now Jaguar is part of Jaguar Land Rover, which is owned by who knows? I've lost count. It could be an Indian group. It could be a German. Who knows? But we're talking about the late 60s, aren't we? So give me a little bit of color, a little bit of background, if you can, please, Giles.
I certainly will. Well, so William Lyons was the founder of Jaguar, and not everybody really understands that as a company, it didn't just hit the ground running with sports cars. He started in a little back street in Blackpool making sidecars that went on the side of motorbikes. And then he graduated to building a body on the Austin 7. And there were various steps that this guy took in the 20s and 30s to become a car manufacturer. He did it from absolute scratch. He didn't inherit money. He wasn't an aristocrat, anything like that. He just built that company from nothing at all. And as you may know at the moment, Jaguar is sort of having a pause of making all its existing models, and it's going to relaunch with a super duper electric car in a year or two. And this has been very controversial amongst Jaguar fanatics, because they sort of think that, you know, why is the company chucking away its entire heritage to do this? Anyway, so that's the sort of current background to it.
Right.
And I've always been very interested in William Lyons. He's a fascinating man, a very private person, never spoke much in public. And one day I was going through some old papers and I found a copy of a speech that he gave in 1969, as you said earlier, about how he started the company. It's as far as I know, it's the most detailed account that ever came actually from his mouth about how he did it. You know, it's not an interpretation done by a historian or a journalist or anything. It's in the first person. It's how I achieved it myself. And I read it a couple of times. I thought, this is just fascinating. And there is actually a scratchy version of this available online where it hasn't even got the end of the speech. It was recorded very badly at the time. But I just thought, I would like to publish this as a way to say, if you're interested in Jaguars and you want to know what the guy who started it all thought, then here it is from him, right? Directly speaking.
Yeah.
And so in a way, Sir William very kindly wrote most of the book for me. but it is unexpurgated. It's the straightforward transcript of what he said at the time. And I don't think you'll find anything anywhere else that gives more detail. Because as I said before, he was very, very, not cagey. It's just he was quite shy, quite restrained, old-fashioned kind of a person. He didn't, you know, spill his guts regularly in public. And so it's the genuine article.
But you see, the thing is, Giles, I mean, if you look at, people think of Jaguar and they think, oh, Jag, you know, it's your bank. You know, if you grew up if you were a child of the 70s, Jags basically meant the XJS or those big, horrible British Leyland jobs that sort of Tom Walkinshaw was muscling around, you know, in the European touring cars at the end of the 70s. But it was the new Avengers, wasn't it? It was the one that Gareth Hunt sort of drove. But if you go to earlier than that, then there were some very, very sort of seriously sporty Jaguars. I mean, I'm thinking the C type, the D type, of course, which, you know, Mike, you know, which did wonderful things in one Le Mans or Mike Hawthorn, etc. And then there's the Geneva Car Show in 1961, where they present the E type, and even the Italians sit up and take notice.
That's right. Well, you know, it's interesting that you just home in on the sort of crucial period, really. Because when Jaguar became part of British Leyland in 1968, and Sir William was only there for another 3 or 4 years before he retired, it all went into a kind of stasis. Up to that point, every few years, they'd bring out another amazing car, which just pushed the boundaries of design and performance forward. And when British Leyland kind of takes it over, and Sir William goes off to play golf and, you know, sort of get away from every day being at the office, because he was quite an autocrat. You know, what he said went. And every time there was a new car like the C-Type, D-Type, E-Type, whatever, it was basically his own money gambled every single time on this product. And he had a very, very good intuition about what worked. But it's from that sort of exactly the period you mentioned, Giles, that the cars go into a sort of, you know, sealed-in aspic stasis. And right the way through the sort of 70s and 80s, you know, they're just making, they're making the same old stuff. And, of course, it's got leather upholstery and British Racing green paintwork and all this kind of thing. But what I'm trying to say here is that I think we, as car fanatics and consumers, we tend to have this idea that a Jaguar has to be sort of traditional. But that is an accident of fate, yeah. Right? Because Sir William was always looking well over the horizon at the next thing, which is why all the classic Jags are so amazing, because they made such an impact. And it was, you know, it's at that point that you know, everyone gets this idea of, oh, a traditional Jag. But he would have been horrified at that. It's not what he wanted. He wanted futuristic, exciting car all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, you know, again, because it's British Leyland's influence means it goes to basically sort of the motor equivalent of, you know, like a tease made, basically, with a walnut interior and, you know, it's permanently tuned to Radio 2 and a leather holster. But if you, you know, if you think about the Jags, you know, again, that even after the war, I mean, you know, Bond originally doesn't drive an Aston Martin. He's driving a Jag. He's driving one of those, you know, it was for young men, to, you know, your RAF pilots to enjoy. And as you said, it was cutting edge. It was doing lightweight. I mean, the D. I will bang on about the D types all day before we even get to the sort of, you know, the E types. But it was, as you said, it was cutting edge. And perhaps the great irony of this 1969 speech is that British, you know, Jaguar under British Leyland becomes conservative, and all those great British cars manufacturers that go in. I mean, we're not even going to mention the Princess, for goodness sake, or the Austin Allegro. I mean, they're absolute, you know, driving. It's the equivalent to driving a sort of a TV radio cabinet, isn't it?
Yeah. But I mean, you know, Jaguar was sort of, from the moment British Leyland started, was starved of investment because they had so many problems elsewhere. Jags were just seen as cars that they didn't quite build themselves, but they had a very good reputation and they didn't need to worry about it. You know, they were pouring all their money into firefighting and other problems. So, and of course, that set in train a kind of standstill in advancement. And Sir William, although he retired in 1971, that was a company built by one man, really, and for most of the time owned by him too. So he used to regularly like sneak into the factory. You know, you'd think he'd spend all his time on the golf course or sort of, you know, going on holiday or whatever, but he was always popping in through the back door just to sort of see what was going on.
Well, and cutting and shaking his head and going, oh, for goodness sake.
Well, he probably was, but he, you know, I think he had a very depressing time in the late 70s because he saw the thing he built up, you know, really quite reflective. And it's only when it gets floated on the stock market in the 80s that Sir John Egan comes in to rescue it. But Sir William is, you know, brought back. And John Egan said to me, you know, he said, I just couldn't believe that they had ignored this man for 15 years, you know. And so the first thing I did was ring him up and say, would you like to be life president? And Sir William said, oh, well I am already, actually.
Now, the subtext of the book is it says the speech was the future of the specialised car in the British. Now, this is 1969, so everybody's getting into, you know, Bertone is doing all these, the Italians are coming up with these futuristic wedge designs, you know, that will end up as the Lancia Stratos and all that sort of thing, and the TR, you know, the Triumph TR7, shudder. But because everybody's talking about sort of, you know, people are driving sort of pods with gullwing doors. I know Mercedes have been doing it since in the early 50s, but you know what I'm saying? They're trying to revolutionise how we're going to be, you know, doors, you know, people going in the back of the car or going in the side of the car, or, you know, with the, there won't be proper steering wheels and they'll all be run by, you know, run by sort of basically what are almost PlayStation controllers these days. So what is his vision then of a specialised, you know, which is a subject, a specialised car?
Yeah, well, he does, at the back of his speech, at the end of the speech, rather, he does sort of future cast a little bit into where he sees it going. And as he's delivering his words, the very first XJ6s are being delivered, and they're getting rave reviews. So that was a car delivered by a relatively small company, much, much smaller than Mercedes-Benz. A fantastic engine, brilliant road holding, everybody loved it. And Sir William is starting to say, if you're going to be a specialist car manufacturer, you've got to offer something that the big guys don't. Mm. And he does reference, actually, quite surprisingly, the Ford Mustang. Because he says, you know, this is a threat to us, because they make one tin can and then you can have, you know, 56 different versions of it with any number of engines and air conditioning and go faster stripes, leather interior. So what he's saying is to his assembled audience, I mean, whether they're listening properly, it's difficult to tell. It was the Institute of the British Motor Industry, so they're probably all, you know, sort of dozing away by the end, but they're not the most foresighted people. But he's really sort of saying, we have to think beyond all this. So what is coming next? And, you know, you're talking about those crazy Italian cars with gullwing doors that we all had toy car versions as kids, you know, we were running around the sofa and the dining room table. I mean, I think he might well have actually sort of, you know, adopted some of those ideas, but done them in a Jaguar way. You know, they would have been gullwing doors, but you open up, they've got nice walnut cappings on the inside.
the other thing, Giles, is strikes me, this is 69, and of course, 4 years later, boom, energy crisis, 73, OPEC. It changes the whole thing. Everybody's suddenly looking towards those little Japanese cars that are starting to come across, and it changes the whole landscape as well. And I don't suppose, I mean, he, you know, he may have been visionary, but I mean, even Sir William Lyons couldn't have seen that one coming.
Well, I slightly disagree, actually. I think he probably would have been a lot more clued up than we realise, because when you look at pictures of him around this time, he just looks like a lovely old man, sort of like a favourite uncle, sort of elderly, kind of benign and everything. But he was a very, very sharp cookie indeed. So I think he probably would have been well abreast of the trends, and he would have been thinking, what can we do that is a Jaguar thing that slightly sidesteps what everyone else is doing? Because that's the, you know, that's the interesting thing about previous Jags, is they were always different to what everyone else did. And, you know, that's very, very brave for a single individual to do when you've got a big factory, loads of employees, lots of capital that you've gambled. You know, that's what makes him so interesting. In one hand, he's very, very quiet and reserved. In the other, he's very, very adventurous, you know, imagination for a car industry person.
I find it very interesting, because I mean, even now, and I mean, I'm based in Spain. You get a certain sort of person who will drive a Mercedes, but let's not even go there in Spain, because there's a legacy, because of an awful lot of German technology came over here. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink, say no more. But also, you get that sort of, there is a sort of Madrileño type who will drive a Jaguar. They'll even drive Morgans, for goodness sake, because they like that Anglophile thing. And it's really, so in a way that, you know, Jaguar is still respected. There's still a huge brouhaha when Jaguar decides it's going to do a gender-neutral, you know, advertising campaign, and the, you know, and the Daily Mail goes into a complete meltdown about that fact. One of the great British Bridge. But if you think about the companies that are around in the '60s, so I'm thinking, you know, you're thinking your BMCs, you're thinking your Roots Group, and they, you know, with the Hillmans and stuff, and they don't come out of it. I mean, there's, you know, very few people. I mean, Mini's been reimagined, okay, but Jaguar, it still has, you know. Despite what it's been through, people would still recognise a Jaguar. They'd still recognise the badge in a way that they wouldn't with maybe a Peugeot or something like that.
Totally agree with you. I think the previous strategies of the sort of noughties and the 2010s, they're sort of coming up against world events. It's not just the Tesla factor, but, you know, every time somebody in Europe buys a Japanese car, a Chinese car, scrub Japanese, I meant Chinese. Every time they buy a Chinese car, they're hammering not necessarily a nail, but a small tack into the coffin of the European motor industry. So those Chinese cars are all developed with state aid. So they're subsidized, really. And it's very, very difficult for a company like Jaguar, which has tried to sort of extend downwards into more of a sort of mass market, you know, BMW 3 Series type area. And I think they've taken the view that the future trends just mean if they continue doing what they've been doing, they'll be going out of business. So they've got to do something different. And I think with the success of the Range Rover, which is now £150,000 and top export from the UK, they're trying to come up with something that's a Jaguar that can sort of follow that trend and really go for the, you know, the real upper echelon, the real sort of high-tech showcase. This is very, very difficult for people to swallow if they've grown up with a second-hand XJ6.
Yeah, but, you know, and I've just had Wimbledon, backhand return here, Giles, and you'll agree with me, Porsche. Porsche, for example. You know, a Porsche SUV, a Porsche Cayenne, you'd go, no way. You know, Porsches are 911s, that's it. And however, you know, I'm in Marbella, there's a lot of wealth. Forget your Chelsea tractors down in Marbella, my friend. You will see nothing but Porsche Cayennes dropping off the, you know, little Svetlana, you know, outside the private school every morning.
And I mean, the Cayenne is, you know, it's been long been the most profitable part of Porsche. But, I mean, there's two things there. Porsche diversified a long, long time before Jaguar did it to S&Bs and so on. And the other one is, you know, I keep reading that, you know, Porsche faces a difficult future as well, because we just have this army of Chinese-made and funded vehicles coming. And people quickly forget, you know, the Tesla came from nowhere, and now you see them everywhere and friends have them and you see them around and you just think, zoom back 10 years, who would have thought that a disturber, a disruptor would come into the market quite like
a disturber? I think that was the best. That's the best slip you've had all day, Giles, to be honest with you, with Tesla.
So I mean, I think Jaguar have taken they've taken a bold strategy, and it hasn't, in a way, it hasn't gone down too well with some of its, you know, fan base. But you know, with the greatest respect, I think perhaps young people live in the past a bit too much. Can I say that? I mean, it's, you know, I include myself in that. So it's very different from running the factory, keeping the employees going, making profits, reinvesting and so on. And then actually, that takes us right the way back to William Lyon, because he did what he did really on a shoestring. And it's amazing how nimble he was thinker in the early days of Jaguar. Yeah, so that's a little bit what I was trying to sort of bottle up in this book is you know, his authentic recollections of how he actually did it.
And if nothing else, it's a fascinating time capsule of a man, you know, at the end of the 60s, you know, we know what happened. We know the sort of the spiral the British car industry is about to go in. So this is, if you like, it look, you know, this is a final hurrah on the horizon, as it was from a guy who was instrumental of the British car success up until that point.
I think that's right, actually. And I'm very fortunate to actually know his grandson.
Yeah.
Michael Quinn is a lovely man. And he's actually done a foreword for me about the book. And, you know, sort of recalling how he used to, you know, go around for Sunday lunch, and Grandpa was quite a, not an austere figure, but, you know, somebody had to be respected. You know, table manners were important. He couldn't cycle on the grass around the gardens, all the rest of it. He's got some lovely, lovely stories in there. You know, he's a man from another era whose legacy is with us. You know, you said this earlier. It's true. And that's why I find it so interesting that the legacy has remained. Sir William died 40 years ago this year, so he's been a long time gone. But here we are talking about what he made and where we go with it.
The book is called Sir William Lyons on Jaguar, The Legend Explained in His Own Words. It is by Giles Chapman, who we're speaking to today. And it's all got a preface by Michael Quinn, grandson of Sir William Lyons. Giles, if people want to find you online, I know there's a website because I stalk you on a regular basis. So where's the best place to find you?
That's disturbing in a way, but also quite flattering.
Every celebrity needs a stalker, Giles, and we Gileses must absolutely follow each other. It's the unwritten rule of the Gileses.
Yeah, where do you find me online? Well, you find me, you find a lot of my stuff on Amazon because I've written 60 different books about car culture of different types. So I'm there a lot. And sometimes some of the interviews and articles I write manage to make it through to readable form online too. So I do quite a lot of journalism, but you know, I'm old fashioned. I like to see my name on a print piece of paper.
Yes, really, so. I know. There's nothing better when you see a little thing on a column. It's there, but, you know, in a little picture. That's.
And I gave up on my X account because I just found the environment for me personally wasn't quite right. So I occasionally post nonsense onto LinkedIn about things that I like about cars.
Well, listeners, by the way, you can order the book by going to our own virtual bookstore. You'll see the front cover, which is a wonderful front cover. And it's got a couple of Jags on the front of there. Somebody's come in. The only Porsche will remain a 911. The rest are an abomination of the mark. There you go.
I mean, I'd hate to tackle someone on that topic at a Paul Jones Club meeting.
The book is called Sir William Lyons of Jaguar. It's by Giles Chapman. Giles, we'll have you on very, very soon again, but thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. And I'm just really so flattered that you've taken interest in my work. So thanks very much.
Trust me, when you're a petrolhead like me and your name is also Giles, it's an absolute shoo-in. Giles Chapman, thank you so much for your time today.